Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 95% of the world's population is breathing unsafe air. Air pollution is the fourth leading cause of death around the world. Those are just a few of the findings from a pair of alarming new reports on air quality. And the U.S. isn't doing much better. One report finds that more than 130 million Americans are breathing air that is not healthy. And these reports are coming at a time when the Trump administration is rolling back air quality rules. This hour, On Point, big questions about the air we breathe. You can join us on air or online. How do you rate the air quality where you are? And have you seen a change around the world? We have made significant strides on air quality since the 1970s, so is the Trump administration right to roll back rules now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me today in the studio is Dan Greenbaum. He's president of the Health Effects Institute, a nonprofit that researches the impact of air pollution on health. Their annual State of Global Air report is out this month, and it found that long-term air pollution exposure contributed to more than 6 million deaths around the world in 2016. Dan, welcome to On Point.
Well, great to be here, Megan.
Also with us today from Washington is Janice Nolan, the American Lung Association's Assistant Vice President of National Policy. She wrote their 2018 State of the Air report. That's their annual report card on air pollution across the United States. It was released just last week. Janice, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, let's start with you and sort of the global look on air pollution. The most sort of striking fact from your report, or finding from your report, is this idea that 95% of the world's population is breathing air that isn't healthy. Tell me more about that.
Well, across the world, the World Health Organization sets guidelines for what they consider to be safe or healthy, unhealthy air. And we in the U.S. have similar guidelines. They're very similar, the numbers. And when you look at what the levels of air pollution are in every country across the world and where the people are, of course, with millions and millions and billions of people in places like China and India, you see that 95% of the population of the earth is living in places with air above those safe standards.
And what impact is that having on the health of those people?
Well, there's extensive evidence that air pollution can affect both respiratory health. It can exacerbate asthma. But of more concern is it can really exacerbate and cause premature death from things like stroke, heart attack, and even lung cancer.
Okay, so is that where you get this finding that air pollution contributed to more than 6 million deaths in 2016?
That's correct. And that's a combination of both the outdoor air pollution and, for many of the developing countries of the world, the indoor air from the very bad fuels they burn in homes.
Okay. Okay. So so that's very – that's like hyper-local then within individual homes in developing countries. I mean, how much progress have we made on that front in terms of the fuel that people do use for their homes?
Well, actually, there is improvement. And what we see is that as countries improve their economic status, that more and more of the households shift to cleaner and cleaner fuels. They might shift to LPG. Eventually, they might shift to electricity. So we are seeing an improvement, but it still means there's something like 800,000 people dying prematurely from indoor air in India.
Okay. So Janice, I promise I'm going to get to you in just a second here. But these global numbers sort of provide us a framework to talk about what's happening in the United States. Dan, since you mentioned India, in your report, I see that China and India were found to be responsible for half of these global deaths that you're talking about, and that India rivals China for early deaths due to outdoor air pollution. And actually, to that effect, I wanted to play a little bit of tape here to describe what the air can be like in places in India. This is a CNN reporter in the streets of Delhi, India, in 2016, reporting on the heavy smog there.
When you
you walk through the streets of Delhi, you can obviously see it and you can smell it. But the most disturbing part is that you can taste it in your mouth. And if you're not used to being here, you can feel your throat start to burn. In fact, the city's highest court recently said that living in Delhi was like living in a gas chamber.
Dan Greenbaum, tell me more about that.
Well, actually, unfortunately, my business takes me to Delhi and place in things like November of 2016, November of 2017, when the levels of air pollution were so atrociously high, they were almost a hundredfold above the standard.
A hundredfold.
So, and it is very hard to breathe. It does affect anybody who's there. And as the reporter said, you can barely see down the street.
Wow. Okay. Janice Nolan, I appreciate your patience a great deal here. But given the global picture on air quality that Dan has just shared with us, I mean, how does the U.S. as a whole right now sort of rank in comparison to what we're hearing about what's happening in China and India?
Well, it wasn't that long ago that we had images that looked a lot like that in the United States, and we've made enormous progress since then. We entertained some guests and air pollution experts from India and Mongolia last year and showed them photographs of the U.S. in the 1970s and 1950s and how we look today, and they were truly impressed. So we've made a lot of progress thanks to the Clean Air Act. That's been our tool to help reduce air pollution.
Uh-huh. So we're going to talk more about the Clean Air Act and the Trump administration in a second. But nevertheless, you found in your report that 4 out of 10 Americans, some 130 million Americans, are living with significant amounts of unhealthful air?
Exactly. This is a number that we calculate. This is our 19th annual report, and we look at air pollution standards that are set up by EPA and evaluate how many days of unhealthy air communities have compared to what they should be doing or what their level is of year-round particle pollution, particulate matter, and have seen over time changes, improvements. But we do still have far too many people who live in areas that literally can shorten their life, where the air quality is a health risk and even a life risk. And definitely more than 4 in 10 Americans live in a community that got an F for one or more pollutants.
It seems as if those communities are concentrated in certain places, though. I mean, are we talking about urban communities or California? Where is the bad air, essentially?
Well, it's a lot of places around the country. California certainly has and historically has had a huge number of places where they have unhealthy air, but they're not alone. I mean, number one on our list for year-round particle pollution this year was Fairbanks, Alaska, not a place you normally think of as having unhealthy air, but because of the wood smoke problem that they've got up there and improved monitoring, we now know that they have not only a short-term problem with it, but a year-round problem with particles. Other parts of the country that have lots of pollution include urban areas, but they can also include rural areas. It just depends on the community. We've got several counties, for example, where oil and gas extraction is happening, where they're very rural counties, but they have unhealthy levels of ozone.
Ozone. Okay, so talking about ozone in particular, I guess I want to just take a step back with both of you, Janice and Dan, and say, okay, so on the one – air is a complicated thing because on the one hand, we can make significant changes locally, right, within municipalities or cities. But then on the other hand, talking about ozone, it really is a global challenge, right? I mean, how does – Dan, let me start with you. How does climate change play into whether or not we're seeing rises or drops in levels of low altitude ozone?
Well, it's very interesting you ask that because we're actually gathering a group of experts in just a few weeks in Chicago at our annual meeting, including scientists from Columbia, from NOAA, who are studying exactly that. That ozone, first of all, can travel long distances. The precursors from China can find their way to the United States. But also, it's the one air pollutant because it is formed during very hot, humid days. It's the one air pollutant that has been really closely tied to changing temperatures and the other changes we're expecting from climate change.
Janice, what's your thought?
We saw that this year in our report when we had 2016 added to the data. Our data that we looked at this year were 2014, 2015, and 2016 data. And 2016 was the second hottest year on record. And we saw a lot of places had spikes. They had many days that had high ozone that they hadn't had before. And the climate, the temperature definitely played a role in that.
Okay. And so then, I mean, if we just jump quickly to the idea of how do we solve this? How do we get better air for everyone? I mean, is the ozone level challenge one, a thing that's best taken on globally? Or perhaps can places like Los Angeles, Long Beach, Bakersfield, who come up at the top of your list there, Janice, do more at the local level?
Well, we've done a lot of things both locally and nationally. We have made a lot of progress in fighting ozone. We have far fewer days than we had when we first started doing this report, which looked at the late 90s. We can definitely use both, and California does a lot individually as a state on its own. But we also have measures. For example, a couple of years ago, we adopted a rule that required cleaner gasoline, and that gasoline removed sulfur, which was toxic to the emissions control systems in every car out there. And when that less sulfur gasoline was used, cars reduced emissions even more, even the cars that had been on the road for a long time. And that was a national step that we could do. And we've done things like that nationally to help both at the local and the broader picture range.
Dan?
Yeah, ozone is particularly challenging. We did a study in Southern California just last year, which showed over 20 years dramatic improvements in all of the pollutants, and actually showed that kids' lung health was better by the time they were 17 if they grew up in the cleaner air. But in the Southern California area, there was a substantial reduction in ozone for the first 10 years of those 20 years. But then the remaining 10 years, we've seen a leveling off. It's a complex mix of different pollutants that come from vehicles. They come from paints. They come from other things. And whether or not you've got the right mixture and the right techniques in every region makes it hard to figure out how to solve the problem for the long term. Mm.
Well, we are talking about the quality of the air we breathe, both on a global level, where the picture is highly varied depending on the country and city that you live in. It's not too healthful to be breathing the air in places in China or Delhi, as we heard earlier, but also here in the United States, where, for example, California has 8 of the top 10 most ozone-polluted cities in America. We'll hear from a California mayor when we come back. Just wondering what you're seeing where you live. Has the quality of the air improved or not? And what do you think we can be doing at the local, the state, and the federal level? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Ever listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking a look at two alarming new reports on air quality, both globally and nationally, and what we need to be doing to continue improving air quality. My guests today are Dan Greenbaum. He's president of the Health Effects Institute, a nonprofit that researches the impact of air pollution on health, and their annual State of Global Air report is just out this month. They found that long-term air pollution exposure contributed to more than 6 million deaths around the world in 2016. We're also talking with Janice Nolan. She's the American Lung Association's Assistant Vice President of National Policy. And their 2018 State of the Air report is an annual report card on air pollution across the United States. I want to get some calls in here if I can. Wes is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Wes.
Hi, Meghna. The Tennessee legislature just passed a bill a couple weeks ago eliminating vehicle emissions testing across Tennessee. So while having cars tested every year was inconvenient, I completely recognize, you know, the inherent accountability of periodic vehicle testing, which this is kind of a disturbing trend that I've seen in many red states over the past few years. I believe Florida and some other states have eliminated emissions testing. I think many forget how polluted the air was in cities in the 1970s. We've come, you know, such a long way. Using clean air as evidence for the relaxation of clean air regulations is like saying, well, my doctor cured my lung cancer, so I'm going to start smoking cigarettes again.
Wes, thank you so much for your call. Janice Nolan, what's your response to Wes?
Well, I saw that. Nashville is my hometown, and I was very concerned to see that because I have family who still live there. Knowing that the risk of having equipment that doesn't necessarily get monitored on a regular basis means that it's more likely that things don't work and you're ending up with a problem. But it is a sign, I think we're hearing as well, we've seen nationally, efforts to try and roll back things after they've been found to be effective and have worked is a trend that we're seeing in a lot of different areas. And it is very disturbing as a national trend.
Well, so to that point, I want to bring in another guest. He's Ledge King. He's joining us from Washington. He is a USA Today reporter. He covers the Environmental Protection Agency. Ledge King, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Magna. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to bring you in here because you've done some really interesting reporting on the changes that the EPA has made around rules on air quality. For example, or the EPA and the Trump administration more broadly, was it just, earlier this month that the president signed an executive order telling the EPA to change air quality standards or rules that he says get in the way of business expansion for a growing economy? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's right, Magna. I mean, this is part of the Make America Great Again agenda, which is focused on deregulating a lot of the often Obama era, but even earlier laws and, well, regulations that business often saw as an impediment. So the latest one was a directive he sent to the EPA to essentially work with states to revise the ambient air quality standards. And that would affect six key pollutants, including ozone, and give states essentially more flexibility to, you know, interpret, revise those standards in a way that would be industry friendly.
Right. So, I mean, typically, though, or I guess up until this point, those national ambient air quality standards were mandated to use the best available science without consideration to cost to industry, right?
Yeah. I mean, for example, what they call a non-attainment area. So essentially, metro areas are considered one area. These six pollutants are measured, and if they don't attain, if they're not below a certain standard, they are considered non-attainment. They have to do certain things. Industries, factories, et cetera, have to meet certain steps before they can be approved, et cetera. So this would allow more flexibility. And environmentalists obviously are wary of that term, and it could mean that it's going to be easier for industry, factories, manufacturers to build the plants, et cetera, that they've been trying to do.
Right.
I mean,
just
over time.
So more specifically, I mean, I'm seeing here that the administration and the EPA has basically said that regarding those non-attainment areas or construction in those non-attainment areas, they've been saying that the problem is that review process that you mentioned can take years. It incurs extra time, extra cost to ensure that industrial activity won't make air quality worse. And they're seeing that now as an impediment to job and economic growth. Saying that the air quality is measurably better now than it was in the 70s, so why have such strict regulations?
Exactly. And I think nobody would disagree that air quality has gotten better for a number of reasons. And that's the argument to keep the regulations in place, isn't it? I mean, things are working. Why change? But business has been complaining, has been lobbying to change these rules so that more people can be hired. There can be greater economic growth, and which obviously is a prime rationale for the president's agenda. What is interesting, if I may add, is that the directive to the EPA was not really cloaked in let's keep Americans healthier and their air cleaner. There is that, but it was mainly directed with the notion of let's help manufacturers hire more people.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting directive to an agency that's charged with protecting public health.
So, Dan Greenbaum, let me bring you back in here, because I know you've taken a look at this for a period of years. The interesting thing to me also about what the Trump administration is doing is I said a little bit earlier that the EPA was charged with using the best available science and not to consider costs to industry in its rulemaking. But one of the changes that the EPA is making is, for example, it's going to now discount some studies about air quality because of a claim of lack of transparency around those studies, because the analyses use individual health data that can't be disclosed due to health privacy laws. So it's kind of turning the fundamental or the most basic premise of why EPA does what it does around clean air on its head entirely.
Well, one, it is a big challenge here, and I wanted to say two things. One, I used to be the commissioner of environmental protection in the state of Massachusetts, and I had to file state implementation plans, the very things that Led was talking about. And it's not a simple process, so I understand that they're trying to make it faster and get the EPA review of it faster. But there's this underlying current that suggests that we're going to try and somehow limit the science that might be available. Scientists do need to be as transparent as possible with how they're doing their science. And there's a very large movement. Everybody we fund will make their data available afterwards, and that work should be used. But there's decades and decades of work that's been out there that are used by EPA to tighten rules and sometimes to argue that we don't need to tighten rules because the studies don't argue for that. And if you apply a set of standards that says I can't use that science anymore, it's going to really undermine the ability to make smart decisions, frankly, for manufacturing as well as for public health.
Janice Nolan, jump in here. I mean, I'm seeing some environmental advocates saying that they see the Trump administration's moves, not just the one this week, but there were other memos issued over the past 5 or 6 months, as effectively directing EPA to reconsider almost all of its past guidance on federal air quality. Is it as sweeping as that?
Absolutely. I mean, we are seeing the same kind of thing that we've been fighting for 20 years. None of this is all new. I've got quotes from the 1980s where industry is saying, oh, you're going to keep us from having jobs because of this stuff. Part of the challenge is that we are very concerned about the fundamental science being challenged. And that's something that happened in the late 90s. I've got a piece of paper of a PDF of a story from the U.S. News and World Report from the late 90s where they were arguing the same thing, where major studies were actually sent to Dan's organization and reviewed independently there and confirmed that the data were absolutely on track. Because they don't like the results. The results are showing that premature death is one of the most serious health effects from these pollutants, and that by reducing it, you can save lives, and that has enormous economic benefits. And they don't like the fact that what they're seeing is that the benefits of these things outweigh the costs. Now, we're getting into two questions about the science. One thing I do want to say is we're also concerned about who's looking at the science. We're seeing changes within this administration where they're trying to replace people who are academic scientists who have had an EPA grant or have an EPA grant with industry scientists who've been funded by industry, because they're arguing that the EPA science, the people who've got an EPA grant are not going to be completely open because they've got an EPA grant, but they're willing to let industry folks in who have industry funding to come in and challenge the science. This process has gone on since the 1970s, and the decision to use health as the basis for setting the limits on air pollution was upheld in a Supreme Court decision in 2001, a 9-0 decision written by Antonin Scalia. It is not exactly weak. And so the fact that they are challenging it through process rather than trying to change the rules is an important factor to recognize as we're looking at the way that this administration is trying to weaken these provisions. And remember, too, that the president's...
Can I just jump in here, though, because since you brought up the court, wasn't there also a 2015 ruling from the Supreme Court that said that federal agencies can repeal rules through policy memos and don't actually have to go through the full regulatory process to do so? I'm seeing someone's reference here, Perez versus Mortgage Bankers Association in 2015.
Well, that's a different set of issues than setting standards. Setting standards are based on what it takes to protect human health. The process for how you figure out how you meet those standards is a completely different process. Mm. And that process does involve cost-benefit analysis. Okay. But the process of saying, where should we be aiming? What's the amount of pollution that's safe to be in the air needs to be a health-based decision solely, because the estimates of – it's like trying to figure out, all right, what is a fever? What's the temperature for a fever? That's what we're talking about at that decision-making process. Yeah. And that's what they're talking about affecting, is changing the science that influences that, changing the people who are reviewing it, so they're going to be more willing to allow more pollution to be in place as a fundamental goal of the target of where we should be aiming to clean up the air.
Well, Janice, Dan, and Ledge, if you, the three of you could just stand by for a minute. I want to bring in one more voice here. Who deals with this issue front and center in his life every day. And that's Mayor Robert Garcia. He's the mayor of Long Beach, California. And unfortunately, Los Angeles and Long Beach share the joint honor, I don't know if that's the right word to use, of being the most polluted city in the United States, according to the American Lung Association's 2018 report. Mayor Garcia, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Regina, for having me.
So first of all, I mean, just this is L.A. and Long Beach have been at the top of the list for air polluted cities in the United States for quite a while. It's not necessarily a distinction that you want. Just why hasn't more progress been made there?
Well, I think obviously the most of the pollution that we have is really related to the port complex. So the complex that's there in Long Beach and Los Angeles is the largest container complex for ports anywhere in the United States. And about 40% of all of America's goods, the things we wear, the things we buy, come out of Los Angeles or Long Beach. It's the number one and two largest ports. And so because of that, when you add truck pollution, when you talk about what happened with the dirty diesel trucks, you know, decades ago, and the ships, the terminal process, it really has created an issue for the whole region. And it's not just the ports, of course, it's the ingress and egress of trucks that are coming in and out of the ports and into the freeways, into the truck system. So that has been the issue for us for a long time. Fortunately, that's begun to change. And so if you look at air pollution today versus what it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, there is a dramatic reduction.
Yeah. Mayor Garcia, you make a really good point about the influence of port activity in Los Angeles and Long Beach. And I think you were probably trying to get to this a second ago, but what was it, just last year, you signed an agreement to move towards zero emissions trucks and yard equipment at the port.
That's right. So we signed the Clean Air Action Plan with Mayor Garcetti from Los Angeles. And so the Clean Air Action Plan is probably the most aggressive port plan as it relates to sustainability anywhere in the country. What it sets is essentially a zero-emission target for both 2030 and 2035. At 2030, we're trying to set a zero-emissions port complex. And by 2035, we're trying to get all of our trucks to be zero emissions as well. It's ambitious, and certainly there was a lot of opposition to it, but we've already seen zero-emission terminals be successful at the ports. We just opened one, the first one, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, and it's dramatically changed and improved air pollution. And so we think that we can hit those targets. And we're really excited about the kind of revolution that's happening within trucking, but also terminal operations when it comes to electrification.
Yeah. What effects, though, are you seeing today on residents of Long Beach because of all this of this air pollution, this bad air? I mean, what Janice Nolan was telling us earlier, and so was Dan Greenbaum, about the measurable health effects, asthma, things like that. I mean, are those a particular problem in Long Beach?
Well, absolutely. I think any city, and Long Beach and Los Angeles obviously surround the ports, but for our two cities and for some of the smaller cities up and down the 710, which is the named freeway that comes in and out of the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, there's no question that we have larger rates of asthma. More children have issues as related to health, particularly if you're up in that area. And so we, of course, as a community, have been pushing for years to clean up the ports. Now, it's important to note that since 2005, the port has dramatically cut diesel particulates. I mean, nitrogen oxides are down. Every measure has made the air cleaner. But we do see the effects on families. And so we have to invest more on things like filters in schools and ensuring that we have adequate park space. And it is costly. The cost of not being sustainable, in our opinion, is more costly when it comes to lives and health than the cost that businesses can have to invest with us to clean the ports.
Well, that's Mayor Robert Garcia. He's the mayor of Long Beach, California. Mayor Garcia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dan Greenbaum, let me just turn to you there. Do you think that they can make significant strides forward, specifically regarding all that pollution coming out of the ports of Los Angeles?
And Long Beach and Los Angeles are probably the best example of a community and a port taking initiative to make this happen. And we've got documented evidence already at the port of dramatically reduced exposures to diesel exhaust.
Yeah.
We at HEI have scientists at UCLA actually studying how that change is affecting health and exposure throughout California, because those goods have to go someplace. They don't just stop at the port.
Oh, interesting. And as the mayor was saying earlier, there's the analysis that they have to do about the cost of doing nothing and the health costs there. Well, we are talking about two very sobering reports on the quality of air, both globally and right here in the United States. I'm joined by Dan Greenbaum, Janice Nolan, and Ledge King. We'll get to your calls when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking a look at two recent disturbing reports on the quality of the air we breathe and about recent rules changes at the EPA around air quality standards. I'm joined today by Dan Greenbaum. He's president of the Health Effects Institute. Also by Janice Nolan. She's with the American Lung Association. And Ledge King, USA Today reporter covering the EPA. Ledge, I wanted to come back to you because we were talking about changes being made at EPA around air quality. And there's two memos that sort of were quietly put out by EPA in December of last year and January of this year that I just wanted to explore briefly with you because it gives us a sense in terms of how things are changing there around air quality. This December memo I'm looking at stated that EPA is no longer going to second-guess companies' calculations around their expected pollution output after big projects get underway. That's been previously known as the New Source Review. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. So essentially under the heading of more flexibility, companies are going to have more ability to essentially get around the rules that have prevented them from expanding, from polluting. And they've been looking for this for many, many years. And so it's going to be a lot easier for them to pollute, essentially, they would argue with that characterization. But under the New Source Review plan, they would do that. They'd be able to do that.
Okay. So sort of trusting industry calculations then as a primary source of information. Now, the second memo issued in January of this year, I think that's got a lot of environmentalists concerned. It's repealing a Clinton-era policy known as once in, always in. So essentially, if I have this right, it's facilities, once they are considered major sources of hazardous air pollution, no matter how much they reduce that amount of pollution, they can never be considered minor sources and have less stringent regulations put on them. The Trump EPA is undoing that.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, under Obama and previously, you could never go back home, in essence, to put it in that sense. But right, so now, again, more flexibility for industry. If they show that they've made certain strides to improve air quality, they'll be allowed to work under more lenient rules. And this is industry's argument for years, for decades, which is we should be recognized when we do a good job. And they feel they've been put upon, they've had to carry this burden, and they need to be recognized for the, you know, when they do good things. But yes, so this, and this essentially does. I mean, for Trump, getting people back to work is priority number one, and this is part of that.
Mm. Janice Nolan, what's your take on that?
We're very concerned, especially about the once in, always in, because it's allowing more toxic, I mean, literally carcinogenic, hazardous air pollutants that are out there to be continued to be emitted. I mean, the original rule, which has been in effect the way they do it now since 1995, required that they use the maximum achievable control technology and keep their levels below a certain amount. This would allow them to expand that up to the limits of that amount. But even if they've gotten lower, they could go all the way back. Say they went back down, they could go four times as much as they're producing now and still be within that level because of this rollback. It is a major problem for people who live, especially who live near these sources. We've been dealing with the kind of enforcement issues we've been talking about all along, where people will put equipment in place and never use it. And that's one of the things that we're seeing this as a likely event as a result of this, is that companies that have that equipment will just turn it off and not use it. And therefore, people will be breathing more of these extremely toxic air pollutants, especially people who live near the facilities, and those usually tend to be low-income people.
Right. So, Janice, to the point that Ledge was making, I mean, he was saying that industry has felt that it ought to be rewarded for its compliance with EPA air regulations. And I'm seeing here, for example, Ross Eisenberg, who's the vice president for energy and resources policy with the National Association of Manufacturers, has said that over the years, in fact, the opposite has happened. He sees regulations on air quality having become so complicated that it's nearly impossible for them, according to Eisenberg, to secure approvals needed to open new facilities.
The main thing is to do is to protect public health. That's what the Clean Air Act requires. And one of the things we have learned is that air pollution is more complicated than we thought. And as industry changes and as they adapt and make different things, that makes it a little more complicated. But the fundamental goal is to protect the lives and the health of Americans, especially those who are breathing air that's downwind of these sources. And we're seeing that that is, unfortunately, has been a challenge all the way through the Clean Air Act, is to get that protection in place. That was what Congress intended when they adopted this law, and what has been the goal of it ever since. And we as a nation, that is our primary source. And we can celebrate all we want to celebrate, but the challenge is, are we doing what we need to do? And the science is telling us that we have things in place that are working. What they're talking about is rolling those things back. And that is something we would strongly disagree with.
Mm. Dan Greenbaum, I have a comment here from one of On Point's listeners on Twitter. Hap Connors is asking, is the Trump-Pruitt destruction of clean air and water laws considered a chemical attack on the American people?
Well, I think one of the things that we fortunately can realize is that there have been a tremendous number of announcements and relatively little in the way of actual implementation of these changes. The budget cuts that were announced have actually not been put
in place. EPA budget cuts.
The EPA budget cuts, because Congress did not go along with them. They would not stand for those kinds of cuts. Having said that, I think
– So hang on just a second. So EPA budget cuts, then we have the plan to roll back the Clean Power Plan. We have the proposals to make new emissions standards less stringent. So are you saying that it's been, from the Trump administration, more talk than action so far on all of these fronts?
Well, there's also the rules, the proposal to revisit the standards for more fuel-efficient vehicles,
right,
that just recently was put out. These have been announcements, but there is actually no rulemaking. There's no actual change going on in some of those places. And once the actual hard facts get put in place and courts have to look at them, I think people like Janice and her colleagues and others are going to look at that very closely. Are there concerns? Yes, because I think you have to pay attention to cleaning up the air and continuing to push it forward. On the other hand, there are companies who are out there, the diesel truck manufacturers, who've actually innovated, put in brand new technology. It's actually got bipartisan support to get into every truck and bus in the United States. And there is a Trump proposal to exempt one category of trucks. In fact, the truck manufacturers and others are opposing this, to exempt it, these so-called glider trucks, which would increase air pollution.
Right. So I'm going to get to callers here in just a second. But Janice Nolan, let me just jump back to you here because – you know, on the one hand, I appreciate Dan Greenbaum bringing up the point that we've had lots of announcements, but the changes in rulemaking, there's still a process to go through. But it got me thinking, going back to something you were saying earlier, that under Scott Pruitt at EPA, there also seems to be sort of this simultaneous fundamental shift in terms of how science is used and viewed at EPA. And, you know, I mean, Scott Pruitt himself has a history of, when he was Oklahoma Attorney General, suing EPA on exactly some of these issues. I mean, could that potentially have a longer term impact on air quality rules going forward?
Absolutely. If you are looking at ways of changing the science and saying you can't consider these major studies, or that they put people in place who are evaluating the science, who are predetermined to believe that that's probably not something that's going to benefit their industry, then that definitely affects what the standards are that you set. It affects what you consider to be safe levels of pollution, which mean that for at least some time going forward, you're not going to get the protections to which people are entitled under the Clean Air Act. You may not know that air in your community is unhealthy because they're not talking about it at the level that they consider to be unhealthy when it actually is. I mean, we're going through long-term reviews of some of these things, and they take a while. But it definitely has people involved in it who historically have been among the scientists who are the most experienced and most knowledgeable, including industry scientists. But this, what we're seeing are trends that would weaken that approach and would definitely want to make it a lot more favorable to industry and a lot less science-based.
Yeah. So our callers have been very patient here, and I appreciate that. So let's get to some of them. Ashley is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Ashley.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your thought?
So we live in the Nashville area, like your earlier caller, Wes, and my son, from the age of about one until about six, had to go to the ER at least a dozen times for issues related to his breathing. His pediatrician could not treat him in office and sent us to the emergency department every time. He suffered from wheezing, rapid breathing, and chronic recurrent croup where he couldn't breathe and his lips turned blue. And during his worst case, a respiratory therapist in the hospital at Vanderbilt Children's told us that, you know, on these bad weather days when the air quality decreases rapidly or the weather changes dramatically, the ER fills up with kids who have breathing problems. So I just wanted to highlight that these things have real consequences for our children, and just eliminating things like emissions testing, like our legislature just did, have real consequences and costs both emotionally and financially for families.
Ashley, thank you so much for your call. Dan Greenbaum, do you have a reaction to that?
Well, she's really speaking to one of the things that's been known about air pollution, and particularly ozone air pollution, for many years. There have been studies going back decades in camps of kids exposed on high pollution days having more asthma exacerbation, more asthma attacks. It's not every single kid, but it's large numbers of them. And that's why the doctors see that in the emergency room. So there is a scientific basis for action for setting the standards. And it has, as she said, a real human cost.
Let's go to Jeffrey, who's calling from Freiburg, Maine. You're on the air, Jeffrey.
Taking my call. I wanted to just draw attention to something that you've touched on, but I think there's a major battle going on in this country on many fronts, but especially around the environment, between wealthy investors and corporate executives who try to use the excuse that not having strict environmental rules and regulations and follow-up on clean air and clean water is anti-jobs, when in fact a lot of the studies have shown that when they're in place or when they're not pulled back like the Trump administration and obviously Scott Pruitt's trying to do, that does not create new jobs for the middle class or the working class. It simply puts more money into the overpaid executives at all these large companies and to the investors. So, for example, I have cousins who live in a beautiful leafy suburb of New York in Connecticut. And they vote Republican because, for them, their stock portfolio goes up. They have better investments. They think the economy is doing better. And they live in a town because Connecticut has good air quality, and their town is beautiful and leafy and green. There's no industry there. They don't perceive or experience bad pollution. Hmm. And this I think of this as a big PR battle.
Yeah.
Between the reality of the facts that we see in environmental studies and economic studies, and this wool that's pulled over the eyes of many voters, that it's a jobs versus environment equation. Even if you leave out, what I think is true, that clean energy could create a lot of jobs, even if you leave that out, the choice between decent air and water for everyone and 5% of the population doing better financially is a foolish choice that somehow those of us on the side of the environment and mostly the Democratic Party, we have a big PR campaign we have to do to get people to understand the reality.
Yeah.
Of this.
Jeffrey, let me just jump in here because we're running down on time, but I appreciate your call. Dan Greenbaum, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, it's just interesting. I'm not going to speak to the broader issues, but there is it's very interesting to see because we work in China, which has started to really aggressively go after its air pollution problem, that the central government in China understands that pollution is waste. If a factory is polluting, it's very inefficient. And they've actually been promoting enhancing the efficiency of their industry, enhancing the efficiency of their plants, so they could both improve their economy and reduce pollution at the same time.
Janice Nolan, what's your response to what the caller said?
I think we've got, since 1970, we've been tracking these data that show that we can clean up the air and still have a lot of jobs, still have a strong economy. We have reduced pollution by about 70% since 1970 and increased our economic GDP by more than 200%. So these are not mutually exclusive by any means. And in fact, tackling air pollution is a job-creating thing because you've got new technologies, new industries that help us figure out how to reduce these emissions and have done so since we started the Clean Air Act. It's not a reality that cleaning up the air actually does hurt jobs. It just does not.
Mm. Ledge King, you've been really patient here, and I appreciate that. I'm just wondering what you see. Are there any more changes coming through EPA regarding air quality rules? I mean, because it really does seem like, as you were saying earlier, there's a fundamental shift in terms of the administration's view on what the role of EPA is regarding air regulations.
Well, yes, I do think there'll be more. What exactly, I'm not sure. But let me just say this. Scott Pruitt has been the deregulator that Donald Trump wanted in that office. He's been aggressive. He's been fast. And to Dan's point, no, the rules have not. I mean, there's still a process that's going to take, and there'll be plenty of people suing when those rules and those proposals come out. But they will be coming out. And one of the reasons that Donald Trump, President Trump, keeps Scott Pruitt in the job, despite, I don't know if you've seen the litany of spending issues
around him, yep,
issues, all that, is because he is doing exactly what the president wants him to do. So, yes, I expect more.
Well, Ledge King is USA Today reporter. He covers the EPA. Thank you so much for joining us, Ledge.
Thank you.
And Dan Greenbaum, president of the Health Effects Institute, a nonprofit that researches the impact of air pollution globally on health. Dan, thank you so much.
Great to be here, man.
And Janice Nolan, American Lung Association's assistant vice president of national policy. She's the author of the association's 2018 State of the Air Report, an annual report card on U.S. air pollution standards across the, or air pollution rates across the United States. Janice, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.